Everyone, John Wertheim here for this week's Sports Illustrated / Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast. And in-studio guest today, Pat McEnroe, has made his way down to Lower Manhattan and is going to spend some time with us here on the banks of the Hudson. You, of course, know Patrick as a former top 30 player, number 3 in doubles, is that right? And a longtime ESPN broadcaster. So good conversation coming up here with Patrick. You'll notice that we're taping this after we spoke, just to really make sure it was a good conversation. But I can vouch for that. We talk shop. We talk a little bit about state of the game, how to get more American kids involved, and what it was like growing up McEnroe. So here's Patrick.
Thanks for coming down. That's a good
nice,
effort.
This
I appreciate
is a nice
that.
Setup you have here. Very, it's impressive.
This is media in 2019.
Listen, we got to do what we got to do.
It's changing times here, but thanks for coming in. You know what? I thought I would pump you full of gas before we started in earnest.
Okay.
Now that you're here, I'll tell you a story.
All right, let me hear.
Which I had a business lunch right before Wimbledon.
Right.
The guy says, "Oh, you cover tennis? Do you know McEnroe?" And you assume this
he
is someone who says, "Oh yeah, I used to love McEnroe and Borg, and
right.
I don't follow tennis anymore." And
right.
What he,
those were the days.
Those were the days, exactly.
Right.
And I don't know any of these foreign
tennis
players'
is
names.
Boring now. Right.
That's what I was bracing myself for.
Right.
He was not at all a fan, but he went to Trinity.
Okay.
And he said he went to Trinity on account of a McEnroe family scholarship.
Oh, wow.
I don't think he knew your brother's name.
Really?
He knew you.
Okay.
And he did not want me to use his name, but he said it was okay if I told the story. But he's eternally grateful, and he
was
said
he a
the
tennis player? Did he play
no,
tennis?
No, he didn't know anything about tennis.
He got in on a scholarship.
This guy, I don't know, your family had, he said you and your brothers were all very nice to him.
Yes.
And I think there was an endowed scholarship that enabled this gentleman who's now a titan in business to go to Trinity.
You've done scholarship good. Kids at our academy.
Exactly.
You can
we're
on the other
give
side
you the name
now.
Afterwards. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, that's funny. Well, we can talk about that later. But
now you're
in fundraising to it. But you're the McEnroe family made quite an impression on Trinity.
Well, even my brother's kids went there, and I moved out of the city, but who knows?
You went there, though, right?
I did. I should
point this out. I should have said this, too.
I went there through high school, and John went for 4 years. Our other brother, Mark, went for 2 years because he had tried boarding school for a little bit, didn't like it, came back, actually loved Trinity. I went for 4 years, only had to commute 1 year from Queens. John commuted 4 years.
That's a schlep.
4 years on the LIRR and then on the subway, 2 and 3 train at 96th Street, which I did for a year. And in fact, my freshman year of high school, I played basketball. I always played soccer all through high school, as did John. Yeah, played on the high school team 4 years, even while I was, number 2 or 3 in the country in tennis. And then the freshman year I played on the basketball team, but I wasn't particularly good in basketball. So I was on the freshman team. So I had to go in the morning to practice before school. So I had to get on the train at pitch black at whatever 5:45 in the morning at LIRR, and take the do the train. It was an hour commute each way. Got mugged on the way to basketball practice one morning on Amsterdam Avenue and like 93rd Street because I used to zigzag from 96 and Broadway to get to 91st and Columbus. I was not pleased.
That's we should point out to you. I mean, first of all, this is a private school, but you
yes.
do not sound like this is an entitled private school experience. But also, you guys grew up. Basically, east of the tennis. I'm saying for the fans out there. You grew up east of the tennis center, and this is on the west side of Manhattan.
Exactly.
So
we grew up in Queens, which was sort of the end of Queens, but it was really more like a Long Island kind of suburban little town. But it was a nice, middle to upper class town that we lived in. My dad had become a law an attorney and became a partner at his law firm. That enabled my parents to move into the nice part of Douglasson called Douglas Manor. They used to live in Flushing, and when they first got married, in an apartment. And then on the other side of Northern Boulevard was, sort of a middle-class area. And then when my dad became a partner at Paul Weiss, big law firm, which he worked for his whole life, they moved to the Manor, which is where we learned how we got into tennis, because the Douglasson Club had 5 tennis courts. And in the summertime, you could pick, wanted to do like swimming or sailing, or tennis. And John, believe it or not, was 8 or 9 when he picked up tennis, which is pretty old. to
become
late to become a pro. Right. Forget about number one, and so that's how we got into tennis.
And no, we should point out John is 7 years here, senior, right?
Seven years. Yeah, six and a half, seven. Yeah, seven and a half actually. Yeah, he's just turned 60.
As long as you brought up John,
yes.
I will say one of the great upsets in tennis.
Right.
John McEnroe had a younger brother,
right,
who carved out an identity for himself. I mean, people are literally like,
right,
"Oh, I always forget Patrick is,
right,
John's younger brother."
Right. Patrick was a decent player. Right.
No, but I'm, yeah, I don't mean in tennis. I mean,
oh,
I mean, I don't mean as a player necessarily.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you've managed to that's a considerable shadow that you've managed to step out.
Well,
of.
It helped me along the way. It was a burden, you know, at times, obviously, even as a player. But I think it certainly helped me get my opportunities in TV. And in radio, et cetera. It certainly helped me get an opportunity first with ESPN and at CBS. Actually, when John recommended me to CBS at the U.S. Open right after Vitas had suddenly died, because Vitas was doing amazing.
Right,
it was great,
right,
on TV.
Right.
And so when Vitas passed away sort of suddenly, they were looking for someone to sort of, you know, replace him. And I had just started doing some stuff for ESPN because I had come off a couple shoulder surgeries, so I was sort of dabbling in television. So John recommended to Bob Mansbach, who now works with you guys at Tennis Channel, who was a longtime man at CBS. He said, "Why don't you try my brother?" So that was sort of my first, you know, foray into doing the U.S. Open when I worked for CBS.
And that wasn't long. You didn't have the 5 years at consulting saying, "What am I doing?"
Yeah, no, I was there for a few years at CBS until I sort of went full time with ESPN.
But I feel like you really, and I don't know if this was by accident or design, I don't think people see you as John McEnroe's younger brother, per se. I mean, I think you've really, it may have been in the beginning, you may have, you know, I imagine it was a benefit, but also
you need to
sometimes a millstone.
You need to follow me around to come to the airports and stuff when people say, are you?
They see the last name.
Yeah, so that's normal. But I thank you for saying that. I think in our world, our little media world of tennis and et cetera, I think I've earned my reputation, you know, by able to do multiple things over the years, which I always strive to do more, to be able to do different roles. So I think that all my experience has paid off.
I wonder, I mean, we don't have to turn this into the therapist couch, but temperamentally, I think most people would agree.
A little different? Yeah, a little different, yeah, but that was even true growing up. So
is that right?
Yeah, and I think I'll tell you this one quick story because it did. I was a little bit of a baby playing tennis as a kid, which is not uncommon for any good junior player, you know, as a 12, 13, 14-year-old. And so John was actually, you know, he had his moments, but he was basically a pretty tame junior player until, you know, stuff happened at Wimbledon when things blew up and he became super Brad, et cetera. But when I was 14, I was 14 or 15. I played in the National Clay Courts in Knoxville, Tennessee. And Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh.
So I was a, you know, fairly highly ranked national player. And I was playing in a round of 16 or quarterfinal match, something like that. And the photographer came out onto the court. And they just let him, you know, walk right onto the court. There's no rules or anything. So this camera person is sitting there right by at the middle of the court, not doing anything, no pictures. So I'm winning like 6-2, no problem. Second set, I'm up 5-3. All of a sudden, the other guy starts coming back. I start, you know, losing some points, getting frustrated. So, you know, I take my racket and kind of, you know, slam it on the ground. All of a sudden, I hear click, click, you know, I hear the guy taking a bunch of pictures. You know, I'm making faces and all that. So I ended up winning the match in a tiebreak in the second set. So I move on to the next round. And the next day, I come out, I'm staying in the dorms at Vanderbilt. That's where we stayed. And the front page of the Tennessean, you know, the big paper in Nashville, has the title, "Oh, Brother."
Oh,
and me slamming my racket, you know. And so my dad always said, you can't be like your brother because they're watching you and they're paying no attention. You know, you can't do that. And of course, he used to yell at John. And then John and I always laugh about it. Oh, gee, I wonder where John got his temper. My dad, how could you do that? You know. So that did impact me as a kid.
You're a junior player.
I was a junior player, right. And I had a little bit of a temper, but I was more mild-mannered generally than John, which is partly why I wasn't as good as a player. I wasn't as quick either. That was the other part. But then, you know, that did sort of – I did realize that I was being watched a lot more as a kid coming up as
right,
a junior.
Right.
So I think it did impact me a bit in the way I sort of behaved on the tennis court.
I'll reiterate. I think it's remarkable how I don't think people see you as anything other than Patrick McEnroe. So I commend you on that.
That's good. Thank you.
So your summer, we're whatever, two weeks after Wimbledon.
Yep.
What's your summer like?
Summer for me is working at the tennis academy, the John McEnroe Tennis Academy here at Randall's Island. So I'm not as present in the summer there as I am all year. I'm actually there a lot during sort of our school year, which is our main focus for most of our kids. We have a big summer program too. So, but in the summer, I have a little more leeway with my schedule. So obviously, family time. Although my girls are all away at sleepaway camp. My wife's a singer. She's been quite busy performing, so I went to Cape Cod with her. She had some shows there.
Nice.
She was in D.C. this past weekend, Washington, D.C. So we sort of juggle. I go up to see my twins at camp this weekend, upstate New York, and then I bring them home. And then the only really TV responsibility I have for the summer is to do the Canadian Open in Canada. I usually do Cincinnati as well, but we're taking a little family trip to Italy at the end of the summer before the madness of the U.S. Open.
I think Tuscany.
Well, Tuscany.
Tuscany over the over Kings Island.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
It's tough. It's a tough
great
one.
Great priorities you got there.
The food, it's tough. You got
Applebee's on the
Applebee's
side. I always love that tournament,
right.
Though, for
it's
that reason.
I
always say that it's great to see these players removed from their comfort zone. And
oh, totally. Like, you're used to these, London and Paris.
Yeah,
and
right.
York,
like,
you got to go deal with
Feliciano Lopez is walking barefoot through the Cracker Barrel parking lot on the way to the Marriott. So I figure, I get bombarded with these tennis questions.
Right.
And they're great. It's whatever. It's great.
You get a good one, especially on your mail.
But it's like, you know what? It's a great sort of pulse of the tennis fan.
Right.
So, here are some of the things they're asking these days,
okay.
And you have at it. So right. One of them, what is today? Tuesday. Coco Gauff is about an hour from taking the court.
Right.
What do we think of some of the restrictions placed on her schedule?
I think they're okay in general. I mean, I think she has plenty of opportunities. I mean, let me tell you one thing. If my dad were here, who was the ultimate, personal freedom and, from a legal
perspective. Exactly.
Yeah, total libertarian.
Right, right.
Like, I used to argue with him about the ATP. How could they make the players play X number of tournaments? This is against the law. So it's probably against the law, probably. But I think, all sports have certain rules and age limits, whether it's, the college guy, coming through the NFL to get into the NFL. So I think in general, you can work around it. Coco Gauff is going to work around it. She seems like she has great parents that are supportive of her. She's obviously an amazing talent and, worked around. So she had to play qualies in D.C.
Right.
So she got a couple extra matches. The tournament is like, thank goodness. Wow, they got great crowds on the weekend. She wins a couple matches. She's in the tournament. It's all good. So to me, it's not really worth going down this road of arguing. Is it, in her case, do you make an exception? Let her, she doesn't have to play every week. She can play whatever, 12 or 14. I mean, they have all these sorts of variables.
Yeah, right, that's the thing. It's not like she can't. People.
Right. I mean, she can still play.
She's banned from playing. She's not banned from playing.
She's not banned. She's just, and I think the WTA is trying to do the right thing.
Right.
To help. And the fact of the matter is that even in the women's game, as we're seeing in the men's game, players are playing longer, and it's not – teen sensations winning majors, even on the women's side, like it used to be, when Martina Hingis and winning majors at 15. It's unlikely that that's going to happen on a regular basis. So I think for the long-term protection of the player in the sport, I think it's good.
Father of a daughter as well, you envision, sort of hard not to think about your own kid in that position. You don't want a kid playing.
I don't think so. You don't want him doing all that.
No. What's another? So, Novak Djokovic, what does he do so well? I've gotten that one in a different number
of
different forms.
What does he do so well?
No, but when it's easy to explain Federer, right?
Right.
Oh, it's this balletic tennis, and just watch him, and you can see the
artistry.
I think
it's easier to explain Djokovic.
Nadal's got the – oh, really?
Right. I think it's easier to explain Djokovic because what he does is he plays, the ultimate percentage tennis. So, if you see him – if a shot's coming to Djokovic – I could predict before he hits it 98 times out of 100 where he's going to hit the next ball. Because he's like a machine. But he has such unbelievable movement skills, flexibility, timing, that he can basically put the ball exactly where he wants it, but he does it. You know, Federer is a little unpredictable, which is partly what makes him so great to watch,
right,
and
right.
so explosive. And it's also what kind of hurt him in the Wimbledon final, is because he knew he had to play that unpredictable tennis. And when it got down to like the crunch time in the tie breaks, that was too ended up being too high risk at those moments, because Djokovic is so solid. His balls will get a little more depth. He can pull you a little wider. He doesn't give up as much court as an Andy Murray, as a Nadal does on a mm-hmm. on a quicker court. So to me, he's almost like the perfectly structured tennis player. His movement, his technique, his decision making, you know, when he's on, basically he can just control. It's like a ball control offense, you know, Joe Montana in his prime. Dink, dink, you know where he's going to go, but he can't stop it.
Exactly. Right.
Because it's so well executed. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's so well executed, and he has all the physical tools to be able to do it consistently and do it better than anyone else. Did you see that? I think it was your buddy, the New York Times guy, Ben Rothenberg, posted something on Twitter a couple of days after the Wimbledon final. The comparison of match point, Federer against Murray when Federer won it.
Right.
And then Federer against Djokovic, the 40-30 point.
Right.
So it was really interesting because it showed the two videos side by side.
Oh, right, right. Oh,
and it was the exact same play.
Yeah, exactly. It was the same point.
It was the same point, right, right. But the difference was the execution of Federer's two shots was not quite as good.
Right.
And the movement and the court positioning of Djokovic was exponentially better. Right. No, it was a lot better.
Than Murray.
Than Murray. I mean, it was, you know, he was his balance was so much better.
Right, right,
he didn't give up as much court. His positioning was better. His technique's a little better. It was kind of cool to see that difference because, to me, that sort of sums up why Djokovic is Djokovic.
Right. No, it was the exact same type of point.
Exact same point. Forehand, a serve down the tee, stretch your opponent to the middle, and then run around inside-in forehand approach to the forehand corner. Didn't hit it quite as well, but Djokovic was in perfect position because he returns a little earlier. His balance is better. He doesn't stumble after the return, and that's why the passing shot looked routine for him, even though it was match point.
That's what everyone said, it was such a shabby approach, and anyone you make
you
that
still
approach,
gotta make it. Right.
You're down match point at Wimbledon. You still have to execute
very
that
easy to miss
shot.
That shot.
Yeah. We talked about last week. The other thing was that 40-15 serve.
But he just missed.
That he missed by 2 inches.
Yeah, because he hit two aces that game.
So you go from 21 majors to 15 versus 20. That's 2 inches in a two-major swing right
there.
You
know, I got a lot of response from my comment. Because, you know, at that stage of the match, you know, you try not to say anything, basically, when you're commentating on the match. So we came back from commercial, and both my brother and I and Chris Fowler, you know, really been trying to pull back at that point, obviously. But the comment I made was right before Federer was going to serve for the match. And I said, and I actually said, I can't believe I'm saying this, but this feels like the biggest game of Federer's life.
Really?
Yeah. And I don't know why I said that.
Why'd you say that?
I said that because of what you just said. Because I felt that if he could win this Wimbledon, get to 21, hold off Djokovic a little longer. Finally, he's never done it. Beat Nadal and Djokovic in a major.
Right.
And because no one's stopping Djokovic except Nadal or Federer, right, in the next couple of years. Okay, maybe one
we'll
of these.
Right.
But, I mean, it's certain there's no proof that anyone else is going to stop him from catching him and passing him. And so, to me,
that's really interesting.
To win Wimbledon for Federer at about to be 38, and do it against the two.
That, to me, was a big one.
All those things combined. Right. That's why I made that comment.
So if he makes that first serve, if he wins Wimbledon, then it's 21.
It's 21. It's 15.
It's nine Wimbledons. It's Djokovic. But also, he won his first Wimbledon in 2003.
Right.
So that's a 16-year gap. So that would mean, if you want to play the longevity card,
right,
Djokovic would have to win in 2024.
Right.
The 16-year gap.
Major,
when he won the 2008
exactly.
Australian Open.
Yeah.
So,
Which seems unlikely based on the way he plays, just because it's so much movement based and, you know, precision based. But I mean, look, Federer's been able to do it, and obviously Djokovic is as good of an athlete as Federer, and takes care of himself in the same way. But to see Federer play at that level, at this age. I mean, just to see the final, the way these guys,
right?
To me, like watching even the, just the first set, sitting there and watching it, I'm thinking to myself, these guys know that every single shot they hit has to be played with so much precision, not perfect, but precise, because if they don't play it that well, they're in big trouble on the next shot. And they can get away with that against pretty much any other player.
Play so offensive tennis, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so they just kind of elevated each other. Like I'm watching, if Federer doesn't hit a slice just the right spot with just amount of spin low enough, he's going to get cooked. He's not going to lose on the next shot, but he's going to be on defense. And it was just watching those two guys go at it is just it was phenomenal to see.
What do you think? So, some of an interesting point to me, they said if this is a first-time finalist, it's like this is Milos Raonic, or this is the crack of your life. I mean, this is it. This is your going to the Hall of Fame. This is going to be your career epitaph. Like, in the grand scheme of things, what's the difference? Disappointing loss for Federer. I'm sure he was crushed afterwards, but it's 20 versus 21. If Djokovic loses that match, 16 versus 15. They said, listen, these guys, what's the pressure for these guys? They're in this goat race, and that's fine, but the guy who has pressure is the one who knows his whole legacy is going to rest on whether he wins this match or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some truth to that, and I think that's partly why these guys can play at such a high level, you know, in these matches, because they've done it so many times, and it's not, you know, Federer's always been able to sort of brush off the losses, you know, like it's not, you know, because we've done this for years. I mean, when he lost in to Raonic, you know, whatever it was 4 or 5 years ago when he had the back problem, and it was like when knee, you know, we were like, oh, this could be the last time we see him at Wimbledon. I mean, who knew? So who knew that 5 years later, somehow, you in retrospect, you feel like he knew. Like somehow it's like he everyone panics, all us media experts and former players go, oh, this could be it. I mean, this was his chance. And he's like, yeah, it's just another match.
Right.
And that's been partly the reason why he's been able to last so long. But still, it's still, I mean, I remember, you know, my brother said to me one time when he lost the final, you know, years later when we talked about it one day, when he lost to Lendl, you know, in the French Open final, which was his most devastating loss. And I remember we went out because I was playing in the junior doubles final, believe it or not, against Boris Becker.
Is that right?
Me and Luke Jensen, yeah.
Oh, that's a good, good trivia right
there. There's another good story related to that, but I'll just tell you this point, which was that I said to John that night, because I'm a 17-year-old kid, I'm thinking, oh, my brother's number one in the world. You know, he dominated the whole rest of that year. Oh, you're going to have another chance. You know, you're going to have plenty more chances. This was my chance, he said.
Really?
This was my shot, and I blew it. And and it was like he knew, which is, I think, what differentiates him, which is what makes these guys now, to me, seem, it blows your mind. Because even though Federer's had these moments, you know, match point at the U.S. Open, when you would think, God, how could this guy sleep at night?
Right.
And he comes back, and he just kind of brushed it off. Like, John never could brush that off. Because obviously clay wasn't his best surface.
Right.
So he knew that. He knew, probably if it was Wimbledon, he would have said it differently. But he knew that everything was lined up for him to win that match. And he didn't do it. And he said, you know, you have to have that mindset as a player that this is it. This is my shot. And I think that's what separates like a great champion like him from, you know, other players that just kind of, oh, well, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. Like there's something about these great players that, They can seize the moment,
but and yet John won Wimbledon that league. You know, four weeks later, John dominated. He's winning,
that was grass.
And he won the U.S. Open. Too. And he won the U.S. Open too.
But the French Open was the one. You know, he'll still really say to this day that's the match that you know that keeps him up at night.
I think part of the story you alluded to it already. Part of the story, these three guys are, pick your adjective. They're incredible. They're amazing. Right. It's a golden era. You wish there were a little more resistance by the rest of the field. So let me ask you, if Sasha Zverev called you this afternoon and said, I need a coach, what would you say?
Well, I'm not really into
coaching.
What do I say to him? What do you need to do?
Yeah, what do you make of
this?
Well,
I mean, I watch him and I feel like he just gives up way too much court. I mean, he's so far back. Now against 90% of the players, that's good enough.
Right.
But the problem is, like, you're not playing to beat 90% of it. If you want to be a champion, you have to, like, develop. Even Federer at the Laver Cup, he went up because I was there, you know, as a coach. John's a captain.
Right.
And literally I heard Federer go up to him and said, you need to, when you hit a big ball, you need to move up. Like, you need to cut the court off. And so I don't know what Lendl was doing. Not, and maybe the kid just is reluctant to do it. I know, you know, Lendl did an unbelievable job with Murray, helped him in a lot, in so many ways, mm-hmm. get over the hump. And you thought that would be a nice mix, but I never saw Zverev looking to like try to implement that in his game. You know, he can serve big as he did in the London final indoors, 2 out of 3 sets, okay. I mean, he's an amazing ball striker. But he, to me, he hasn't learned how to like actually make things easier on himself. And team, same thing on a faster surface.
Right.
You know, on clay, he's obviously awesome. But when I watched that French Open final, I was there in the crowd just watching. And I'm like, Nadal, not only is he like this incredible physical specimen, and he can, you know, the top spin obviously is why he has been able to do what he's been able to do on clay. But like just watching him cut the court off.
Nadal.
Him, you know, set one ball up, but predict where the next one's going to go, take it early. He didn't do that like 12 years ago.
Right.
But he, so he's adapted. He's adjusted. He's gotten better. And so is Roger. And so is Djokovic. And these guys, you know, they're not even, it's almost like the gap has grown.
What do you think that is? I mean, the court positioning stuff is really interesting to me. Nadal against Roger.
Right.
Was apparently playing way too far. And Moya, I mean, this was something that had
been discussed in advance. On grass?
Yeah, on grass. Yeah. And basically, I don't know, I think Uncle Tony said this. Basically, it was a function of nerves. Then Nadal sort of retreated to his comfort spot. And
right. They were about all, in the semis?
Yeah, they were all encouraging him to play up, and he knew that was the game plan, and he just couldn't stick to it because he was in his comfort zone.
You know, on clay, he'd be fine.
Yeah.
Probably on a slow, hard court, he'd probably be fine. But grass is, you know, it's still difficult, you know, for him. It's not his favorite surface. He still plays well on it. And that's why I say Djokovic is technically the most, because Djokovic can do all those subtle little things with really no difference in his swing or his preparation.
Yeah, right. It's not a big adjustment for him.
Nadal, it's a big adjustment to move in, to move way in. Obviously, on clay, he can do whatever he wants because there's so much juice on his ball. There's so much, you know, explosion off the court with his normal shot. That no one's ever seen anything like that. That's why he's able to dominate on clay. And he's improved those other things. But, you know, Djokovic strikes the ball cleaner off both sides. Doesn't hit it as big off the forehand when he has time. But he strikes the ball more efficiently than anybody I've ever seen. He's like Agassi, hit the ball bigger off both wings than anyone I've ever seen. Just pure, boom, strike the ball.
Moment of impact.
Yeah. Moment of impact. You know, and he could hit bigger than Djokovic. But he can't maneuver the ball as well, and obviously nowhere near the athlete that Djokovic is.
Right. You think Andre hit a bigger ball than Djokovic?
I think Andre consistently hit a bigger ball, yes.
That's
hit it bigger, thumped it, could take it a little earlier. But because he knew that he couldn't play as good a defense, you know, he wasn't a great defender, he wasn't an explosive mover in the way that Djokovic is, so he had to play that, you know, play a little bit bigger. Djokovic doesn't have to.
I find the gyrations of Djokovic's career pretty wild too. You know, right. He has this breakout 2008 Australian Open.
Right.
And then retreats, and remember Roddick and the bird flu. I mean, the book on him was push him a little bit and he'll crack on you.
Some issues there. I mean, definitely had that issue with his endurance, with the heat, whatever it was, the diet, fixed that. You know, when I was Davis Cup captain, we went to Serbia
and played there.
He was 3 in the world at that point, and he was going through the service yips. So we were playing an indoor clay in Serbia. We had Isner played singles, and I believe Query played singles. And both playing, you know, pretty good level at that point. And I'm telling you, the amount of pressure on Djokovic from that crowd
in Serbia
was more, it was almost like violent, like how intense it was. Like if he lost, I mean, who knows what could have happened.
Right.
I mean, that's the vibe, like, you felt from the crowd. So not only that, but plus he was literally double faulting 1 to 2 times a game.
Wow.
And like, you know, our guys for them played pretty well. We're in the match. You know, I think one match might have even gone 5 sets. One was 4, and I remember Jay Berger, who was my coach, who was my assistant, and we were like, man, if that guy could serve, I mean, you know, if that guy didn't have the service yet, I mean, who knows how good he could be? And then he cleaned that up. He figured that out.
Right.
So he's gone through these different. Then he had the thing, obviously.
Boy, the 2 year. I mean, this
right,
was
the 2 year sabbatical.
Look at his record, and you know, so Nadal would go 2 year, but he'd be injured. He'd get to a final,
right?
And Rodgers been pretty, you know, Rodgers had a couple of stretches, but again, he'd be in the...
He'd still be in the mix.
15 months ago, Djokovic wasn't a top 20 player.
He was 21 in the world, right, when he went to Wimbledon.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just...
Well, he lost it mentally, and, you know, the personal problems that he talked about, and, you know, we can speculate on exactly, but, you know, his issues, whatever they were, personal, and then he obviously had an injury to the elbow. So those things, to me, it was more the personal stuff that he just, his mind just, right. you know, wasn't there. And the way he plays, you know, he plays with a lot of precision, and he plays, you know, if he's a little off, as we saw in some of these matches, you know, he can miss a lot. But that obviously is not happening now.
I just think it's, people say, well, if a couple of match points here and there, and Roger would have 24 majors. And I'm thinking a couple of little tinkers here and there, and
if
Djokovic could just as easily
Yeah, he might be a 24 already.
Yeah. When you – I asked Robbie – I don't know if you know Robbie. You know Robbie Koenig, I'm sure.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, good
Absolutely.
Guy. I asked him the same question. I mean, just sort of step back, and we get out of our media chamber.
Right.
You like where the sport is overall?
I like the athleticism of the sport. I think that I think there's a lot of characters. Unfortunately, not that many of them are American at the top of the men's game. So that's hurt us in this country. I think if you look at the global nature of the sport, it's really healthy. And obviously, you look at the majors, I mean, they just get bigger and bigger. So do the Masters events have gotten bigger and more popular. So I think at that level, the game is in great shape. I think the players are playing at a level that's extraordinary. I think the Wimbledon and the ATP and the, you know, the U.S. Opens have – and Australian Open, when we saw those, you know, crazy six-hour matches with Nadal and Djokovic and Verdasco, I think they've made adjustments with the conditions, the balls, the speed of the court that have helped.
Right.
You know, to me, Wimbledon, like, to me, Wimbledon was different this year. The balls were staying unbelievably low. If you hit it short, the ball was dying. I played in the senior thing, which is obviously, you know, like slow motion, but just to hit on the courts.
You could tell?
You could tell the difference, a big difference.
The surface or the balls?
I thought it was the surface. I know some players say it was the balls, and, you know, they would know better than I do. But to me, it was like if you didn't really hit the ball and it sort of landed in the middle of the court, the ball was like dying. So that's why I think you saw, you know, Federer using the slice a lot more,
right.
the ball staying low. To me, that's interesting because it shows, you know, basically, what to me it shows is who has more skill, who has more tennis skill. And I think Wimbledon realized that, as opposed to making it, you know, when it was super fast,
it
was
just
boom
offense.
Serving.
Yeah.
And then it got slow or slower with a high bounce. And it's like, okay, this is like starting to look like a hard court. So where can we balance it now? So now you play with you got to play with a little slice. It rewards people for being able to do different things
right.
and move in a different way. And I think
that's really
healthy. It's really fun to watch, I think.
You're okay with 12-all?
I'm okay with it, yeah. I thought, you know, it was interesting this year that it was just a final where it happened in singles anyway. But I liked 12-all for Wimbledon because I think, especially for the men in the final set, there are going to be less breaks in general than there are other surfaces. So I think having that sort of one extra set to me is a right
yeah,
number.
Yeah, it's an extra set.
Yeah,
basically.
It's an extra set. Yeah.
It was wild.
It was wild.
The first
right.
200, whatever it is, 253 matches
Crazy.
And it didn't come
yeah.
into play. And
yeah.
Go back to what you were saying about the Americans. I had a corporate thing with John.
Right.
We were talking a little bit about Kyrgios.
Right.
And what do you do? And are the pressures different if he's American? And
mm-hmm.
if he were from Tuscaloosa, would it be a
right.
completely different dynamic? Sort of, are we past the point of we're never going to have what we had 25 years
right.
ago, right? We're never going to have six
no.
of the top 10 guys.
No. I wouldn't say never. You never know. I mean, it could come around, but probably not.
What has to happen? Well, all right.
I don't think any country.
What
will.
Has to happen? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't think any country. Will. It's too,
well,
it's too
what has to
out.
Happen for the U.S. to have two
well,
top 10 players?
I mean, it's well, I think actually we're going to have a shot. I mean, I think between Fritz, Opelka, and Tiafoe, I think they all have a shot to be top 10. Do they have a shot to win majors consistently? Probably not, because each of them have flaws. You know, whether it's Tiafoe's,
the forehand,
you know, the stroke right. production. Fritz is not a great athlete. He's a great tennis player, not a great athlete. Opelka's, you know, so big that he's going to break down.
Right.
But when you look at what they can bring to the table, I think it's pretty solid. Now, that being said, you look at the guys at the top. And, I mean, these guys are just, you know, they're the best athletes on the planet. They're some of the best athletes on the planet. So it's very simple. In my years at USTA,
yeah,
going to
the
tournaments,
yeah.
you know, going to the junior tournaments, I have a here's this. This is what sums it up for me, okay? And I know I'm generalizing, and you can, you know, nitpick it if you want. But generally speaking, here's the problem. you go to a junior tournament in the girls' 12s or 14s, national tournament, you will see a bunch of good white girls. You will see African-American girls. You will see Indian girls. You will see Asian girls. You will see all different backgrounds, not just of race or, you know, but of social economic background.
Right.
Okay. You go to a boys' tournament in general. Okay. And you can make, of course, an exception here or there. But as one of my coaches told me when he went to I called him when I was with the USTA. And I said, what do you see at the boys' national? He says, well, I see a lot of parents with Rolexes.
Whiter than Buffalo in
you know,
February.
So the point is, we're getting the pick of the litter of, I think, athletes as women, as females. Coco Gauffs, the Sloane Stephenses of the world, Coco Vandeweghes of the world.
Right.
You know, Cece Bellis, I know she's coming out of injury, you know, unbelievably quick, athletic. You're getting those young girls more drawn to tennis. Because tennis is the only one of the only sports where they can make it big and make a lot of money, okay. And as a boy, you know, if you're growing up in the South or in Florida or wherever, you know, here where we live, you know, lacrosse gets into college, or you know, football, obviously basketball, baseball. So what happens is that with the kids we get in tennis, unless there's some connection that's family related, that's Tiafo, that was sort of because his dad was working at the place.
Right.
You know, Taylor Fritz's parents were professional tennis players. Opelka, you know, is sort of a freak physically. So you're not getting the pick of the litter.
No,
necessarily.
That's what we always say. I mean, yeah. it's crass and it's probably an overgeneralization, but people, you know, LeBron James at age 8 has already been diverted.
Right. Exactly.
To
right.
football, baseball,
or
basketball,
someone,
soccer.
Yeah, someone who's a little, you know, 6'2", 6'3",
right.
you know.
So
that's part of the issue.
Let me ask you three questions. A, is it just economics that the WTA is the most lucrative sports league for women, but
right.
the ATP ain't for men?
Mm-hmm.
B, is it...
That's part of it, yes.
Is it that... I mean, there's a tangent, but all of these college scholarships that are going to international players...
Right.
Takes away some incentive, and I think is something
mm-hmm.
that's really problematic.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? Someone floated this to me. They said, just socialization. Boys want to be on teams, and it's bus rides, and it's pranks, and it's you know,
mm-hmm.
butt slaps, and it's it
well,
takes a
that,
really
yeah,
special
but, well,
person.
How come Rafael Nadal and Djokovic, you know, and all these guys from Europe are doing?
Who had a yeah, yeah. But yeah. someone it takes a really special kind of athlete to go out there and hit balls, hit 500 forehands,
balls, right.
yeah, a million balls.
Right.
That's a lot different than everyone's on the AAU basketball team and we're all
it does
flying
take,
to
it
Las
does,
Vegas.
It,
for,
yeah, it does take a unique individual to want to do it. You know, to have the passion to do it. Now, so how come girls? We're having more success, quote unquote, at the professional level with young women.
Right.
I don't know, because they're pushed into it earlier. Are they more I don't know. Don't girls want to play on the softball team and the lacrosse team too? I mean, at the soccer team. I mean, soccer is bigger than ever for women and for girls. So I'm not sure that's it. I mean, I do see that overall as a problem for tennis.
Right.
That for you know working at the academy and seeing our you know kids whether they're boys or girls. You know, kids generally want to be with other kids. And play with other kids. So I think that's, you know, I'm not smart enough to know whether it's a male-female issue, if that's more relevant in tennis. Why do we get the best swimmers, though? You know, we have the best swimmers in the world.
Right.
And men and women. I mean, there's obviously other countries, right. Australia, whatever. And, you know, gymnastics. We have great gymnasts, especially female gymnastics, figure skating.
It's an interest. No, I mean, it's a good.
I don't have the answer.
Thought exercise. I don't. I mean, this is just something that was floated to me.
Right.
I mean, they don't think sort of specific to players. They said, look, Nick Kyrgios was born to be a team sport athlete, and you
mm-hmm.
put him in Laver Cup, and he's great, and he
right.
loves the locker room and the ambiance, and he's cheering, and he's doing cartwheels when someone hits a winner.
Right.
And then you put him out there by himself.
Yeah, I mean, he's a unique case, I think, that generally. But I do think that this issue of. Keeping the kids involved and keeping them interested when they're young. I mean, you know, I remember years ago going to the March of Dimes luncheon when I was with the USTA and, you know, where they raise money for this great charity and all the sports people are there. And they honor every year a couple of athletes and a couple of business people in sports. So this one particular year, they honored Michael Strahan, who had just retired, and he was going into his TV career. And he got up and gave a great speech. And, he told the story of when he was his dad was in the military, and so he was a an army kid or and he was in Germany. His dad was stationed in Germany, and Michael Strahan was like 18 or 19.
I didn't know this. All right.
Yeah, and they said to him he was out like they were playing soccer, and one of the someone in the on the base said, hey man, have you ever tried football? He'd never played organized football in his life.
Okay. Is that right?
Michael Strahan had never played organized football. So he's like, sure, you know, and tried it, you know, became a Hall of Fame football player. And I turned to the brass at the USDA, and I said, herein lies the problem, right, for tennis. Because it's impossible to get, to be a college player,
right.
You know, unless you start tennis by the age of, you know, 6 or 7 and play it a ton.
Right.
Now, not that's the only thing you do.
Is hard.
That's what I'm saying. Tennis is very hard. Now working with kids the way I have, because this what's been great about this job I'm doing the last few years at the academy is I'm actually on the court, you know, and working with kids, and which I wasn't really able to do when I was with the USTA. So working with kids, working with coaches, I'm like, man, how the hell? I mean, this is really hard. I mean, the most basic skills that you think are easy are very hard to learn and to teach. And it makes me realize that as a kid, you know, I spent hours and hours at the Douglasson Club to go full circle, hitting against the wall, playing against the wall, basically teaching myself. And, you know, kids don't have time for that. I mean, parents, you know, that's not the way our society works anymore, where you just let your kids go out and play. You know, now we got to have a group from, you know, 4 to 6 and then from 6 to 8 and everybody's got to then get to homework.
Right.
You know, so everything's more much more structured. And I think that makes it more difficult. And especially in an urban area like here, it makes it much more difficult for kids to basically get the reps. I liked the idea of putting on the wall.
Right.
Like I remember as a kid, like I used to play imaginary finals between Laver and Rosewall, and I would just go there for hours. So that takes a special kind of crazy. I mean, I love team sports too. I enjoyed that as being what helped me become a good tennis player.
That's really hard to imagine.
It's really hard to imagine people doing it now. Yeah, it's impossible to imagine.
Go play for 5 hours against the wall. Be Roger Rafa.
Exactly.
Or you can go play pickup and be LeBron. What are we looking for? It's late July, so we've got some. We still have some revelations in the plot.
Yeah,
what are we thinking?
I think we're thinking that it's going to be, obviously the men, the top guys are going to, they're biding their time to, they're all pulled out of. Canada already, or Djokovic and Federer. So you're just going to see them just sort of getting themselves ready for the Open. And, it's still this exact same question.
Three horse race on the men's side.
Can anybody else step up?
Right.
You know, is anyone going to break through? Is Medvedev or Khachanov or Tsitsipas or, is anybody one of these guys? I don't see it.
Best of five.
At this point, best of five at the Open is tricky. It's hot. It's not as windy as it used to be, which to me has made the quality of play better. We talked, the heat's been an issue now. With the roof, there's basically no wind inside Arthur Ashe Stadium.
Right.
So that, to me, is it has some impact. I think that you see less upsets.
And these guys are only playing.
And they're only playing at night or there. And for the women, it's, same old story. Can Serena get over her nerves in the final? I mean, it's not like Serena's not playing well enough to win majors.
Jamie was very quick to this.
Yeah,
nerves, right?
Yeah,
37 years old, 23 majors,
completely,
and it's nerves.
Yeah, because she wants it that badly. And unlike other great players, when she gets tight, her level goes exponentially down. Like, for just some reason, she can...
Well, there's a history there, right?
Yeah, but I mean, she just hit the ball, literally the normal ball, in the bottom of the net.
It's so funny you mentioned that.
But the fact that she's played six majors since the baby, and she's been in 3 finals. So obviously she's playing well enough to win. There's no doubt.
But she's never lost 3 straight finals before.
Well, she's never had a baby before.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, I wonder if she had to do it again.
Right.
She says, I don't give a shit about Margaret Court. I'm just here. I love the sport. I'm out here until I enjoy it. I've got nothing left to prove. And she sort of made this an issue, which she rarely does. She made it a priority.
She wants
this record. I wonder if that wasn't
put a little more pressure on her.
Yeah, exactly.
It's possible. It's possible. I mean, she's always struck me as sort of saying what she. I mean, she's honest, but she doesn't. She's honest, but she's not always honest. So there's always that mystery about her, which I think is what makes her interesting. That you never quite know what she's really thinking.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, this is great.
Thank you, man. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate it. Yeah. Will you pay for my parking next time?
Yeah, was it 19 bucks?
19 here, bucks. Spot hero.
Take my corporate card. thanks for coming in. That was fun.
See you at the open.
All right. Thanks to Pat McEnroe for coming by. We've got to do more in-studio guests. Just a different vibe. Happy to spring for lunch. Jamie, let us free you from your producing duties and bring you in. Had you met Patrick before?
I had not. We text messaged and he butt dialed me a few times in setting up this podcast. But before that, we had not spoken.
Happens to the best of us. I stand by what I said. I'm glad he came in. We were talking about doing this for a while. And he moved out to, we used to live quite near each other. Now he moved to the suburbs. So good to give him an excuse to come into Manhattan. Glad to talk shop with him. But I do stand by what I said before, which is I don't think many people think of him necessarily as John McEnroe's little brother. I mean, I don't think people necessarily twin them together, and they play it up sometimes on the broadcast, and the McEnroe brothers are going to call the match. But I give him an awful lot of credit for carving his own identity. I can't imagine it's easy to be 7 years younger than a brother who is that prominent and for a while anyway was that polarizing, and to have carved such a distinct identity. Thoughts, Jamie?
I thought it was great to have an in-studio guest. I agree with that. It's always nice to have someone sitting next to me on the side of the table. Interesting what he said about Federer, that he said you reminded him of what he said during that match, that sort of this was a really pivotal moment. And I think when he said and he referred back to the matches where we're like, all right, well, this is going to be it. And then Federer goes and proves us wrong. I think we're still seeing that point with him. Like, I don't think that this match and this year is like this big turning point for Federer. I don't think we're seeing that.
I think it cuts both ways. I mean, it's funny because I think there have been matches played since then. There's been a Tennis Hall of Fame induction ceremony, but I still think that fans are processing this match. And on the one hand, you say, boy, Federer came close and that was disappointing, but, you know, he's got 20 of these and the plot keeps moving and there's a major coming up in a few weeks and he has another chance then. I do think there are also people saying, boy, this was his last best chance to win a major. He talks about how his year peaks for grass. It was all set up. He caught Djokovic on a day when Djokovic wasn't necessarily at his best, and he just couldn't do it. And now it's getting really, really hard to keep defending the Federer position at some level, and that there's a sense that Djokovic is climbing the ranks and is considerably younger. And I do feel like, and this is just sort of moderating these texts and these questions that I get, I do feel like there's a bit of a shift, and in this great GOAT debate that has captivated tennis, this does seem like that was a turning point. But we'll see. I want to ask you about Coco Gauff, because I feel as though I am not entirely sure what to think. I do think that people who are talented and skilled generally deserve to be able to apply those talents and skills and make a living. I also feel like this rule is put in for a reason and it's well-intentioned. I mean, one thing that I do think changes the equation a little bit is just that these careers are so long these days, which is a great thing, that when, you know, 25 years ago, 20 years ago, when we were talking about Jennifer Capriati, we were talking even about Martina Hingis, there was a sense of, boy, you really need to make hay while you can, because by the time you're 24, 25 years old, you're on the downside. Even John McEnroe didn't win a major after he was 25. Now I feel like you got 20 years, so there isn't necessarily the urgency. Again, that's a great thing, but I think that's all the more reason to put some guardrails on and avoid burnout, avoid physical burnout. And I think these rules are well-intentioned. I don't think there's an ulterior motive other than protecting kids. And it's at some level protecting the tour and the brand. It's not great for the sport or for the WTA when Jennifer Capriati's rebelling as a teenager and has gotten eaten up by the system a little bit. I don't think there's sort of dark forces. I think this is all well-intentioned. And I kind of am of the opinion that we ought to be abiding by these. And Coco Gauff seems to be a stable situation. I don't think her parents are using her as an ATM, and I don't think there are some of the forces that were there. If you heard Mary Pierce's induction speech at the Hall of Fame, I don't think this is a situation like that with Coco Gauff. But at the same time, I think that you got 20 years to make your keep, and why not limit the kid? I don't think anyone gains by challenging these rules. But I
admit to being a bit torn here. Do you have thoughts?
Do you? We never really got to talk about her after Wimbledon. I don't know. Kind of slipped through. But were you shocked by how many matches and how far she went? Did you think that she was kind of on the brink? Because for me, I feel like we'd heard about her, mm-hmm. and you know, we knew that one day she'd be great, right? I feel like that's sort of the common thing that comes out of, you know, U.S. tennis circles when you've got these young teenagers. But for me, it seemed like she really just like caught fire. And in the way that women's tennis is right now, with a new number one every so often, every so quarter, every major, we have someone new, and we have kind of some new major winners every once in a while. It seems like if she catches fire and she keeps on rolling, I mean, she really could keep going and really make a huge jump. And for me, that when you talk about burnout and everything, I think the one thing that sort of hit Naomi Osaka, and she was in a much different space. She had been climbing up the tour, was that all of a sudden it was sponsors and media and all of this stuff that comes along with the ride. And I do think that at one point that kind of affected her, and she lost early, and she got to take a step back and kind of just hide away where no one talked to her or talked about her. And I think that helped her. And so I worry that about that kind of burnout more so than the tennis burnout per se.
Yeah, physically. I mean, I think it's a really physical sport, and you know, Bianca Andreescu has a great Indian Wells, and it looks like we're going to mint a new champion, this Canadian teenager, and then she has this shoulder injury and hasn't been the same player since.
It's almost like it sort of is blinding, right? The success is like you keep pushing, and you have a little tweak or you have a little pain, and it's like, oh, I have the ability to do this amazing thing. I'm so young. I'm just going to keep going, and then all of a sudden, shoulder injury,
right,
or whatever that injury is. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely possible.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm saying I think your point's well taken about Osaka. I mean, I worry about the physical as well as the burnout and being spread too thin, the commitments, and I think it's a combination.
I just think mentally that's a huge, yeah, mm-hmm, that's as bearing as a physical,
right,
grind.
And I think we've all seen this movie, and you come out and it's shiny and exciting, and the first time you ride in the back of a limo, it's really cool, and the first time you're in a green room of a morning show, it's really cool, and it doesn't take that long before any of that allure wears off and it becomes a burden. And you know, you can train, you can hit a million forehands, and you can work on your overhead, but there's really no preparation for that moment when your agent's telling you you've got to, they'll send a private plane, but you've got to be at the photo shoot in Martinique. It can be really exhausting. And, you know, I mean, we're in the media. We bear some responsibility as well. I feel very torn about this Coco Gauff. I mean, at some level, it's dishonest not to talk about her skills and her accomplishments. She qualified and then won another three main draw matches. I mean, it would almost be malpractice not to talk excitedly about her. And at the same time, we need to give her some space, and we need to see how this pans out. And she had a very nice Wimbledon, but then she played a step up. You know, she played a quality opponent in Simona Halep and looked like a 16-year-old playing against the Wimbledon champion, that there was still room. And I think that we all need to sort of balance the fact that there's this very exciting, clearly very talented teenage player, but also Sloane Stephens said it really well. Like, she's a talented kid, but she's still a kid. And that's, I think that really resonated with me. So anyway, my point is, I suspect these rules could be challenged, and they do seem counter to a certain free market American way, but I think they're there for the right reasons, and we should probably respect them.
I read something interesting yesterday in the Washington Post. Madison Keys talked about Coco Gauff, and she said that it made her reflect back on her career and reignited something in her to look back and be grateful for what she has. But also, you know, she said, I lost it a little bit. Like, when you're doing something for so long, you kind of lose that passion in a way. So it's interesting. It was interesting for me to read that from her and see how someone like Coco Gauff, being so young and carefree, and she comes in, she just does all this stuff, can actually really does affect the rest of the players. I mean, Madison Keys, not that old, not that, you know, hasn't has been on tour for a long time,
right,
but she's not that old. So I don't know. I thought it was.
Yeah, I think everyone. I think everyone sort of played this game with Coco Gauff of, boy, when I was that age, I was blank. Or, you know, the Williams sisters already had put together Hall of Fame credentials when Coco Gauff was born. I think everybody sort of, you know, transposed that and put themselves in her shoes. I mean, again, to me, the big variable in this, and I think it's something that's great for tennis. I think this is a really positive trend. But I think the fact that we don't need these teenage phenoms anymore. And you can have a peer. I mean, Madison Keys has had some ups and downs. We were talking before with Patrick. Djokovic had basically a two-year sabbatical where he wasn't nearly the player that he was. And he recovered from that. And he's still only in his early 30s, and he's off and running. So I think that this whole element of burnout, I think, is really diminished a bit when these careers go into their 30s. But anyway, we'll see how Coco Gauff did. She obviously qualified in D.C. As we record this, she's about to take the court. She did win her first round in doubles, I believe. But we'll see. So anyway, that's another storyline to follow this summer. And I want to thank Patrick for coming in. We'll pay for his parking. Thanks, Jamie, for setting that up. Always good to have an in-studio guest. And I'm on the road next week, but we'll figure something out.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks to Patrick for coming down. Thanks to Jamie for her expert producing and her opinions, as always. And we'll have another guest next week. All right. Have a good week, everyone.